You are listening to the Experience Points podcast for the week of December 23rd, 2015. The gamies are gone, but the goaties are here.
Yeah.
Welcome back, everybody. This is the Experience Points podcast. My name is Scott Juster.
And I'm George Obor.
We're the co-creators of ExperiencePoints.net. It is a serious but not humorless conversation about video games. And we have
we did it.
We conquered 2015.
Take that, 2015.
The con is on. Shout out to the McElroys. We have one more podcast after this.
Mm-hmm.
But we're in the thick of awards season. Last week was the gamies.
The game, which I loved.
Yeah. And whoever didn't love the gamies, you're just jealous that you didn't win. Don't worry, there's always next year.
Yep.
This week, we're getting serious now. It is the Game of the Year awards.
Our conversation about the best games of the year, from our perspective.
Period,
100%. Listen, this is an objective truth. Scott and I play a lot of video games throughout this year. Mm-hmm. I think this year, I've played a lot of games.
Yeah.
I'm kind of surprised.
A lot of strong games, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been a good year. That being said, we haven't played all of them.
Nope.
So, apologies ahead of time if your favorite darling isn't on here.
Mm-hmm. Except if your favorite darling is The Witcher.
In which case, sorry about that.
2015 is really me.
How crazy would it be if I was like, The Witcher's number one, baby, hands down.
It would be the greatest troll, because like I feel like we've been trolling people all year because of our dislike of The Witcher.
Yeah.
And if you turned around and were like, number one with a bullet, Witcher 3, I was like, oh, the tables have turned.
You never know, man. Like, there are those games where you put them down and then you go back 2 years later and go, wow, like that was crazy good.
What was I thinking? Famously in my life, The Legend of Zelda, The Link to the Past was that for me.
Yeah, there you go.
I hated that the first time I played it.
And then you played it
again.
And
now it's probably maybe in my top five.
Sure. Or yeah. Like, I just played Persona 4 this year.
Yeah. So it's like, why didn't I play this earlier? Okay. So here's the deal. George and I go back and forth. We each pick three games mm-hmm. that were our favorite for the year. And a little tradition, we guess as to how much overlap we will have.
Yes, and we've said this on the podcast so far.
Yeah.
I think you and I will have exactly one game shared between us.
Yes, I think there will be...
And I think I know what that game is.
Yes, there will be five different games on this list. Yeah.
Yes, okay. Yeah. So who should start off?
You can start off.
You want me to start off? Okay.
Yeah.
So my number three mm-hmm. game of the year mm-hmm. is... I wonder if you... I'm curious to know if you would...
Where the rank is? Yeah.
So this game is Super Mario Maker.
Oh, man. Yes.
I don't know if this made your list at all, because
yeah.
I don't know your list,
mm-hmm.
But... I played a lot of Super Mario Maker off and on. I haven't made a ton of maps, but mm-hmm. what I have done is also watch a lot of videos
yep.
of people playing Mario Maker.
Yep.
And there was a moment when I was putting this list together that I was thinking, I don't know if Mario Maker deserves to be here because I haven't created a level yet myself. I mm-hmm. haven't mastered it. I haven't dived into yeah. it. But then I think a large part
of... Have you gotten all your deliveries for the new level?
No. Yeah, like I haven't even gotten all of my deliveries, yeah. right, to really maximize the things that I can play around with.
Yeah.
But what I have done is see that Mario Maker is super important
yeah.
for capturing what Mario is
mm-hmm.
and sort of always will be about. So, yep. like, as a historical object,
mm-hmm.
it's absolutely fascinating.
Yep.
On top of that, it's actually pretty fucking cool.
Like, oh, yeah.
I played a level today, for mm-hmm. example, and it was the very original Super Mario
mm-hmm.
version of one of the levels, and I didn't beat this level.
Mm-hmm.
This was a very simple level, but I could not beat it, mm-hmm. right? Because the gimmick, if you will, in this particular case was... designing a level around the absolute minimum height Mario could jump
to progress. Oh, so you really have to feather A. You can't mash it down.
Like,
yeah.
feathering. Yeah. I've got to this scenario where my fingers are in this weird position.
Yeah.
So, like, this is nuts, right? So first, the challenge is you have to run over, like, a jump block.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have to do a feather hop.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are two jump blocks together.
Ah.
So you have to move right mm-hmm. while feather jumping.
Mm-hmm.
And it gets into the scenario where I'm pretty sure to actually beat it, you have to hold down and dash and completely run and hit every feather jump.
So you have to be like ever so slightly tapping A while you hold down the running. Like,
and it is supremely difficult. Yeah. And I mean, until that moment today, I don't think I realized how severe of a limitation that is. That you could be so subtle with your movements in Super Mario.
Yeah.
And every level that I play that I find fascinating sort of does this. Like, it pushes the limits of what Mario is and has been. Mm-hmm. And then every now and then I play a level that is just the pure essence of, like, silly, jovial, really high-quality Nintendo-style levels of Mario. And it's impressive. I've watched basically all of Patrick Klepek's YouTube videos playing Dan Reichert's crazy levels, which are themselves, like, such a fascinating exercise in watching someone think about game design and their own frailties.
Yeah.
Like, Patrick Klepek has this great Kotaku article about how Dan Reichert designed a game level specifically to troll Patrick Klepek because he knew Klepek approached levels in a certain way. And knowing that he approached them that way, it allowed him to create a lot of red herrings in the level, right? And so you start seeing these levels that are designed for specific players in a way that you would never see a Nintendo game before. Like, that's just, it's so cool.
It can't be as personal.
Right. Yeah. And to be able to watch that happen and the game's still going and it's still growing and there's like commentary and there's portal levels and crazy themed levels and people are making music out of it. Like, this is basically the heights of what Sackboy,
Little Big Planet
sort of tried to achieve.
Yeah.
But while still adhering to the rules of the Mario world and sort of paying homage to it in all of the little ways that people design their levels.
I mean, I think it's an interesting example of how sometimes limits are good. You know, like, Little Big Planet had, like, the three layers in the 2D space.
Yeah.
Like, there was, like, there was a more kind of realistically modeled physics engine. But, like, by using the Mario rules, you kind of cut down on the possibility space, but you also get to dive so much deeper into the dynamics of those mechanics where like the feathering of the A button, it's like, that's always been in Mario.
Yeah, always.
But you just haven't gone to the extreme logical conclusion of, like, how subtle is it?
Yeah.
You know, like, we've been kind of messing around with it for decades and now we get to see how subtle it actually
is. Absolutely. Yeah. And the creativity that some of these level designers are exhibiting when they're making their Mario Maker levels is astounding. Like, they're doing awesome things with even, like, little exploits. It's not just that, oh, they're making a block invisible, right? They're making a block invisible and then doing some extra level of cleverness, not even necessarily to troll you and make you fail, but to add a level of surprise that you might not even find in old Mario Maker games, or sorry, Mario games.
Yeah. And it's one of those things that there's actually relatively few of these types of nostalgia plays that are actually as kind of open. You know, it's not, you know, we've never gotten a, like, I don't know, whatever, make your own Resident Evil or make your, you know, like, make your own, like, you have RPG Maker, but it's
not, and there are mods and stuff.
Right. But it's cool to see Nintendo. It took them so long to do this. Like, they could have done this a long time ago.
Right.
You know, but when they did do it, it feels very thoughtful.
Yeah.
You know, like, for the most part, there's not much left out of the game, and it's a nicer package than having to download weird ROMs on your PC to, like, make a hacked Mario level.
Totally. You know? I mean, there are improvements, right? Like, they're adding search on browser right now, which is sort of sad, but Nintendo's always been behind in the online space. But again, this feels like the type of game where, you know, 5 years from now, we'll remember Mario Maker because it still provides some super interesting ideas. And on top of that, you know, it's already being used in an educational context. Like, I think you could give maybe a group of fifth graders Mario Maker, and they'll probably design a comparable level in, you know, an hour or so.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, I think that's, I like that choice. It's also, I think, important. It's an important choice because it speaks to the strange landscape we're in, where it can be your potentially favorite, one of your favorite games of the year, and you've played, like, less than 10 hours of it or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the community is so big, and it's become an entertainment source, as in, watching it rather than playing it, but that's still a legitimate way. Like, it's, I'm so extremely glad that it exists.
Like, in a weird way, I kind of wish that I could always have it on in the background, like an art piece or something, like hanging on my wall.
It just randomly picks a level and
sees, auto plays it or something, right? Yeah. Because there's, I think there's so much cool design there on display.
Yeah. All right. Cool. That, I like that. So let me go with my third here. And it is a game that I played so much that I had to stop playing in order to get things done. And it is Rocket League.
Rocket League. Nice. Yeah. Nice.
I fell deep into a Rocket League black hole earlier this year. To the point where, like, I actually had to make a conscious decision to be like, I cannot keep playing Rocket League and continue to play other games and hold the job at the same time. Like, I just can't. I can't do it.
Unless you decided to go full Rocket League career.
Exactly. Right. If I wanted to really lean into esports. But yeah, I mean, so Rocket League came out, I don't know, it was like fairly early on in the year, I feel like. Free, it was one of the early free titles for PS4. And it just, it took off.
Blew up.
Yeah. I mean, it was like a really organic game. Like, it just kind of
blew up. I think a recent number was saying something like $80 million it made. And it, the price was like a small fraction of that.
Yeah. I mean, I remember.
Maybe it was $35 million it made. But again, very small fraction.
I remember hearing the same figures. And I remember thinking to myself, the budget was probably a couple million. Right. And they brought in like 10 or 20 times that or something. Right. And so it. And, you know, the feel-good story was that they had made another game that was very similar to Rocket League, and they were just kind of a little bit ahead of the time, and it never really took off.
Yeah.
And now here it is.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
And on top of that, right, many of the people who first played this got it for free on PSN.
Yeah.
And then
they still made money somehow.
And they still made money. I think that's a testament to word of mouth, right? Like, everyone was talking about this game for a couple weeks. To the point where I know once it was obvious, then people still bought it.
Yeah.
They bought the PC version.
PC, yeah.
People ended up buying DLC as it came out, if for no other reason than to reward the people who had designed a very solid sports game.
Yeah. That's the thing that I liked about it the most, where, like, it's also a sports game that could only happen in video games.
Yeah.
It's the same way why like, MOBAs are popular, where, like, it's not like you're playing a football game or even a shooter. Like, that has a real life analog. Like, this is a uniquely video game thing.
It's not simulating an existing leisure activity.
Exactly. It's a you know, something that's native to the genre, and it's something that also I didn't realize how high the skill ceiling was until I started watching people online.
Oh my God.
I recognized, like, wow, like, the dynamics in this game are incredible. Like, I didn't even know you could do this, you know, go onto the ceiling, boost off of it, hit the ball down. Yeah. Like, you know, I had no idea you could even do that.
There have been plays that I legitimately thought the ball was controlling the person, not the other way around. Because it was like a magnet. Like, the guy's car was like rotating around the, it was like people massaging are like juggling the ball.
It. Yeah, like,
yeah, through the sky, it, shepherding it. Like,
a car is a Fushigi ball.
It was like that level of God tier play.
Yeah.
And it's not unique. Like, people who've invested a lot of time have become very skilled masters at that game.
Yeah.
On the subject of sports games, I totally agree with you. I think one of the most exciting things about Rocket League is that it sort of marks a path that others can go towards creating new sort of exhilarating sports experiences and esports experiences, right? We're not stuck into this train of only shooters. Now we have MOBA. So just shooters and MOBAs, guys.
Yeah.
Rocket League is, I mean, how would you even begin to describe Rocket? I mean, I guess you'd start by saying it's soccer with cars, but it's kind of a difficult concept for someone unfamiliar with games to understand why a simple soccer with cars would blow up the way that it did.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, there's so, but then, like, once you see it, it's instantly, that's the other, like, that's the beauty of it, where it's instantly recognizable as soon as you see it.
Yeah.
And you know, okay, your job is to drive around and get that ball and that goal. And, like, everything else builds on that one very simple dynamic, and that's it. One of the things also that someone pointed out in an article that I read about it was, unlike many sports games, you control one car. You are one person. You don't flip around from, like, defense to offense. I'm going to, like, press A to get to the guy closest to the ball.
Yeah.
Like, you're one person, one car the whole match.
Yeah.
And so it gives you a sense of ownership over the match. You know, you have to play defense and offense. You have to worry about positioning. It, kind of like a MOBA. Like, it's not like you're jumping around. You have to play your part. And it's something that in a real sport is very similar too, because you can't play a bunch of different positions. You just have to play yours.
Yep.
And it's something that I appreciated a lot of it.
Yeah.
I actually played a lot of one-on-one too, which is even more enraging.
It's too much stress for me.
It's a lot.
One-on-ones.
I mean, and the one-on-one changes into kind of a very subtle game. Mm-hmm. You know, like it's the kind of one-on-one, like a tennis match, where it's just as much about making a move as it is making your opponent make a mistake.
Right. And I imagine in one-on-one, there's so many moments where the ball is just going, mm-hmm. and if you had maybe five extra amount of boost, you would have been able to secure a goal or prevent a goal.
Yeah. And you just have to watch it. And you know, just, it's like, oh, well, you know, I should.
And then you have to watch it again in slow-mo when they don't skip through it.
Oh, man. And that's the whole, like, the culture around Rocket League grew up so fast because so many people were playing it, and it started off as a competitive thing from day one rather than kind of a quasi-single-player slash multiplayer that turned into a sport. Like, from the very beginning, it was a competitive game, mostly focused online, and that means it kind of had that esports thing from day one,
right?
Rather than having to like grow up into an esport.
Is this a game that you think you will be going back to?
I mean, I kind of want to go back to it now because they've started to push out like different modes.
Yeah, like low gravity. Yeah, or there's one where the ball is now a cube.
Yeah, I mean, so like there's I've been away from it for so many months now because I just needed to do other stuff. But like I feel like it's kind of a good time to go back now that I have a little bit of extra time, you know, at the end of the year. But it's dangerous, man. Oh, I'm just gonna smoke one cigarette, that's all I'm gonna do. I won't get addicted.
I mean, I think one of the reasons it is so compelling to go back to is it feels like a game that you know how you can improve.
Yep.
Like there are moments when I just watched a YouTube video and I felt my game get better as I played.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I know, oh, you know what, I want to practice aerials a bit more. Mm-hmm. And so we'll go into matches with that particular concept in mind and get better as I'm watching myself play and watching others play. So there's a level of like, man, I played these couple matches, but I was so close towards securing that goal, or I was so close towards getting better in one particular way or another.
Yep.
Let's just play another one. Because maybe then I'll actually pull off the crazy trick I wanted to pull off.
Yeah. I'll just probably wind up on the upside down on the field.
That's true, yeah.
Help, guys, help.
Well, I mean, being able to know how to improve and actually improving are two very different things.
But it's a thing where it's like you said, like you'd say, oh, when the ball goes in the corner, here is... not. It won't necessarily be successful every time, but you should probably do this maneuver.
Right.
Like, the best practice for this scenario is to go into the corner here.
Yeah.
You know, like it's...
yeah.
This a set of like best ways to play the game crops up really fast in the same way that any sport happens, you know.
And I'm sure as a team as well, right? Because you could position yourself in certain ways to maximize, you know, centering of the ball and then securing the goal.
Yeah, it was quite a fun game.
It's a fun game. I'm glad that's on
your
list.
It was also totally unexpected too. Like it was not even close to on my radar.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. I don't think it was on anybody's radar. And then I have seen it on quite a few people's game of the year lists this year.
All right, second game.
All right, my second game you have not played, and that game is called Life is Strange.
Oh, yeah, I did not play this.
Life is Strange is a game about a girl who can travel through time, and it is a Telltale-esque... choose your own adventure style narrative driven game. And it does it with a huge amount of tact and knowledge about what others are doing in that space.
You mean others as in characters or others as in players?
Others in terms of designers, like who are designing narrative driven games. Time travel itself is used really effectively also, right? Like, I'm a huge fan of sci-fi.
Yeah.
And they weave in the science fiction into the much smaller scale story of a coming of age girl in high school, right? You know, one of the core benefits of being able to travel through time in Life is Strange is being able to say all the right things. And someone asks you a question and you don't know the answer, So you wait for them to tell it to you in conversation, you rewind, and then you say it again, yeah. Right? There are so many moments in life, especially, you know, thinking back to high school.
Yes.
Or the early days of college and stuff.
Where going back in time would probably be a preferable superpower than anything. Like
yes.
Flying,
yeah.
Invincibility,
sorry, flight,
screw it.
Time
yeah,
travel.
Like, yeah.
The ability to change what you say so that you have all the friends and mm-hmm. you say the right things
yep.
Is really powerful.
Yeah.
And then the game knows as well that's not what growing up is, right? Growing mm-hmm. up is being okay with the mistakes that you make, yeah. right? And confronting those and sort of living with them. And the game does a miraculous job of explaining that through the sort of time travel and choice-based game mechanics, right?
They did it in episodes, right?
They did it in episodes. Yeah. So there were 5 total episodes. Yeah. There is a story element that a lot of people were heated about, and minor spoilers mm-hmm. for Life is Strange. But one of the characters attempts to kill herself.
Mm-hmm.
And you can prevent her from killing herself, or she could just die. She could actually go through
yeah. mm-hmm.
and commit suicide. And whether or not she commits suicide is sort of dependent upon whether or not you, as an actual person, remember some of her story elements, right? And so in that moment, it's not about, well, did you make the right decisions beforehand? Can you rewind time and say the right ones? Because in this particular moment, you can't.
Yeah.
It's about, you know, do these characters matter to you, right? Like, are you keeping these things in mind as you're going about doing them, right? And, I mean, on top of all that, I think it's good for so many reasons. I think the voice acting is fantastic. Ashley Birch plays one of the main characters.
Mm.
I forget who plays the lead, but she's awesome. The game also got some flack for dialogue that sounded cheesy, but I think that's just because people don't realize how kids talk these days.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's actually a pretty accurate version of how kids talk for the most part.
Yeah.
And I liked it a lot. I mean, the end gets a little bit muddled. It's not for everybody, but, you know, I've finished
playing. Sounds like they're taking chances, though.
Oh, yeah.
Which is what I like, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Don't Nod came off of making, what was that? It was like an action game.
I don't even know.
Remember Me. Don't Nod made Remember Me.
Oh, wow.
And then they made Life is Strange, and now they're making like another game, another big game. Oh, man, I wish I'd looked this
Remember Me was an interesting thing because like for a while, like that got pushed hard at E3 and stuff, and then it just kind of flopped out and then was like no one talked about it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Weird.
I think they're a French team and it's so weird that, you know, those games seem very different than one another.
Stylistically, tonally.
Right.
Yeah.
And on top of all of that, right, there are many times where I play a game and I'm like, oh, I'm a swashbuckling action hero or whatever. And one of the reasons I liked The Walking Dead was because, you know, I've never played a game as a child or I've never played a game as, you know, well, actually, I have played many games as a dude surviving an apocalypse.
Yeah.
I have never been like a young teenage girl dealing with, you know, sexuality and relationships in a Northwest United States background.
Except for Gone Home.
Except for Gone Home. Like, touché, sir.
But I mean, I think that is the fact that we can basically name, in terms of like high visibility games, Life is Strange, Gone Home, maybe Persona 4.
Yeah,
it's like, it's like the three games that come to mind when it's like games that actually treat teens as people.
Yes.
You know?
Totally.
Yeah.
And I'm such a sucker for coming of age stories too, right?
Yeah.
Like, one of the villains of the game is constantly trying to capture the moment someone changes from innocence to loss of innocence.
Ah, okay.
In a singular moment.
Yeah.
And I think the game does such a good job of saying, you know, that doesn't really happen that way, right? Instead, it's very much like a choose-your-own-adventure game, right? We make a bunch of small decisions, and sometimes they're wrong, and sometimes they're right in the moment, and we're not going to know the repercussions until much later.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are times when you make a decision, a very adult decision, and then you make a selfish one because you're growing up, and then you make an adult one, and then you make a selfish one. And you probably do that for your entire life.
Yes.
And growing up isn't figuring out what the right choice is to make in any given scenario. It's learning how to live with the choices that you have.
Mm-hmm.
And this particular genre is so adept at addressing those themes.
Mm-hmm.
And Don't Nod, I think, is so adept at exploring them in Life is Strange that I feel like it just stuck out with me and I had to put it on my list.
I want to go back and play it. I want to see what they follow it up with, and I want to see how this influences kind of the same way that I wanted to play other games after Walking Dead. You know, how does this influence, you know, what people do with stories?
I mean, especially coming off of our review of the last episode of Game of Thrones from Telltale.
I feel like this is basically everything that we complained about, but the inverse. Like, they did it did it the right way.
You know? I mean, again, it's not perfect, but if you were interested in that genre, I think missing out on Life is Strange is a huge mistake because, you know, it does things that Telltale doesn't do and has never bothered to do and explores them in ways that Telltale cannot do unless they also decided to make a teen time travel game.
we're losing out on the teen time travel market, guys.
Life is weird from Telltale.
Death is weird. Cool. I like that. Okay, so I'll go with my second game here. My second game will also then tell you what my first game is.
Yeah, okay.
So,
because I think this is one of two games.
Yeah, so, and I think this is the one where we'll overlap. So my second game is Bloodborne.
Bloodborne, okay.
Yeah.
Man. Well, I'll just tell you right now, that is my game of the year.
Okay, cool. So we can...
Absolutely right.
And, you know, it... I thought about Bloodborne and my number one game for a long time.
Yeah, like
For weeks.
Can I guess your number one game?
Yeah.
Is it Metal Gear Solid V, The Phantom Pain?
That's what I thought. Yeah.
Okay, good.
I thought about this for probably more than a month. Because, like, by the time I was like...
Ugh, that's rough, man.
Like, we're doing...
Are you sure you've made the right decision even now?
I am sure. I am sure. I've played a lot of both games. Well, let's talk about Bloodborne, because I feel like it can be a toss-up, but I feel like Bloodborne... is an incredible game.
Yeah.
It's just, I don't even know where to start with Bloodborne.
A while back, like a week or so ago, I don't know, every now, you know, whatever, I'm weird.
I was thinking about Bloodborne.
No, I was actually like, I was trying to find an article I'd written on Pop Matters because I think I was looking for something I had said for some reason or another.
Yeah.
I think I was writing one Pop Matters article and wanted to reference another one. So I was going through my list of published articles of this past year. And as one does, I occasionally try to judge my past self and go, what were you thinking?
God,
that's
the
so
worst.
Bad.
Yeah.
And I clicked on the Bloodborne articles and I was reading them and I was like, nope, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
I agree with all of this.
Well, it's not just that I'm agreeing, right? Like, as I say the words, it evokes a feeling, like a shadow of the feeling that I had while playing it.
Yeah.
And to feel like... It feels like Bloodborne when I say it aloud. Like, those words aloud are magical because in my belly stirs some sort of, like, gut instinct of wanting to, like, dodge to my left.
Yeah.
You know? Like, it sticks with me and has stuck with me throughout this year, even though what came out in February, March?
Yeah, it was like a first quarter game. Yeah.
It's still stuck with me throughout this entire year.
Yeah.
And it's not a game that I feel is paralleled in... most ways by any other game this year.
Yeah.
I think that's true of Metal Gear as well. But, you know, Bloodborne stands out amongst all of the other giants of the year.
Yeah. And I mean, just from the practical perspective, like the level of nuance in all the controls, like you have to think at the same time, you have to think so carefully about every action you do in that game. Like, nothing can be a throwaway action. Like, everything you do has to be deliberate, because if you don't do something deliberately, you're just asking for trouble.
Yep.
You know, there's not a throwaway motion. And at the same time, after you... It's a game heavily about repetition and, like, kind of cycling and alternating the cycle ever so slightly until you progress. Like, you're making this loop that is kind of an oblong loop that gets you forward a little bit more every time you make it. And so you get into these familiar patterns, but you're still doing something differently a little bit every time. And then you get into this flow state where it's like, okay, I kind of know my path through the level. Mm-hmm. The level design itself is, like, exquisite. Like, it's incredible. Like, I can't imagine, like, the graph paper that they have to, like, map out these levels, you know?
Yeah.
Like, and the way that you start off in a level and it seems enormous, and it is enormous, but eventually you unlock all of these pieces that fit it together. It's like, oh, I know the geography of this level now. It's just incredible. Like, this type of game has existed for a while, what with all the Souls games or whatever, but I mean, I really feel like this was almost a culmination of, like, what those games can be.
Yeah, one of the things I was saying in a past Bloodborne article was that Bloodborne is a game for everybody. Like, I don't think that this game is too hard.
Yeah.
I don't think this game is, only for the sort of snooty game journalists and critics out there. And I read that article and I was like, actually, I failed here. I don't think I expressed with enough conviction. Mm-hmm. I think this should be fucking like mandatory reading in high school. Like, I think there's so much here that is attuned to what it is like as a human being to struggle with your fellow man and overcome a challenge. You know, there was a moment, one of the final battles, I think it's the boss battle that's like a raven. There's like a pram.
The wet nurse.
And I played it with an ally and we both almost died. And it was like this crazy moment. And then my ally was like firing at the wet nurse. And I think that they died, but like it was right at the moment when they were stunned. And so I did like a full charge and then killed off the wet nurse with the pool. And it was just like, I was in pure awe that we had done what we had done. Like, I was in such shock. And this was the first, I think it was the first time I fought the wet nurse. This wasn't like over and over and over again. And I was just gesturing to like, you know, explain my exuberance and the joy that I had with this person that I knew would like fade in a fraction of a second. Because once a boss is done,
they needed to know that their sacrifice was not in vain.
And it's like, I don't know your name, but I mean, again, like this is sort of what it's like, right? Like you read these moments in great fiction where two people who maybe don't even know their name on a battlefield, right? Like, look into their eyes and they know that they are sort of brothers in arms, right? Like they've experienced something and it creates this bond between them. And in a weird way, almost like Journey, in fact, which is a bizarre comparison, I felt this bond between the people that I defeated that boss with. And I ended up, the final boss I beat with an ally as well. There's this moment of like, you and I don't know your name. You don't know my name, but like, we fucking did this. Like this right here. Like, let this be writ upon stone. We beat Bloodborne together, you know? And that's, I just can't think of a game that's filled me with that same level of exhilaration and relief than something like Bloodborne.
It's a good lesson about the balance of challenging a player versus rewarding them with things and being fair about it.
Right.
And some of the things kind of feel unfair, but at a meta level, they are fair. Because it's like, oh, okay, I get it. Unexpected things will happen and I must be ready for them. You know, where it's like, so at the moment to moment, sure, things can screw you over, but the larger level, it's like, okay, this is how I must interact with the world. You
know? And that alone, that concept, I think, does such a good job of shifting how you think about the game as you play. Like your emotional mind state changes from moment to moment, right? There are moments in the game when you're entering a new area. You don't know what to expect. And you know this game is full of surprises in a myriad of ways. One surprise might be there's a booby trap. Another surprise might be there's not a booby trap. It's okay, just, now there's a booby trap. Or, you know, there are all those moments when you open a door, you see something that's like crawling and rushing towards you and go, what the fuck is that? You close the door. And in an instant, right, you went from, I know how to command my environment to being almost like a child. Like, I don't know what this is. So then going, you know what? I faced surprises like this before. I know what I have to do next, and it's poking and prodding and failing and basically doing science and collecting data. Let's do it. And you open the door again and you face that thing that was terrifying a moment ago and you collect your data and then eventually you come back and you feel stronger and better for it. And that process, not only in my mind, is like such a perfect mirror to what it means to be human, but it's also one of the ways that, like, I mean, again, this sounds like ludicrously hyperbolic, but we as a society advance forward, right? Like, and in weird ways,
incremental advancement against brutishness.
And learning from each other, right? And like, and sharing in that. Like, there are these little tidbits that seem so superfluous, or like weird, just emotional tangents when playing Bloodborne, but I think are genuinely important and genuinely reflect something about humanity in a way that a game that is so often seen as just brutally difficult button masher would never be able to achieve in any other context.
It's mystery that isn't just surprises. It's like, it's a mystery in that you can then understand it. Like, it's everything is a mystery in this game, but everything is quantifiable and observable with enough repetition and work. You know, like, you start off and everything is shrouded in mystery, and you slowly illuminate everything.
Yep.
Like, by the end of the game, you realize how the whole world connects, you realize how the abilities connect to each other, you realize, kind of realize what the plot is doing, yeah. which is, like, it's different than whatever happened for me with, like, Demon Souls and Dark Souls. Like, right. I mean, it's just, it's a mysterious game in a way that I haven't really felt like a game has been mysterious since something like the first Legend of Zelda or something,
right.
where like yeah. everything is kind of a blank slate when you first start, but you slowly get command of the world as you go.
Right.
And I haven't even played the DLC yet.
Yeah,
so I mean, like either. Just talking about it now, I want to just go over to the PS4 and just download it.
Yeah,
it's
so
like
jazzed.
I have to do it.
So with all that said, then convince me why Metal Gear Solid 5 is okay. better on your list
yeah.
or ranks higher than Bloodborne.
As I think both games are, from a mechanical perspective, are probably some of the best games ever made.
Okay.
Like, I think from... And actually, you know, on Mario, too. Like, Mario Maker.
Yeah.
Like, I think this...
These are solid games.
Actually, I think about... Like, thinking about it this year, with the exception of Life is Strange, but it's not, like, a technical-focused game.
Right.
All of our other games, I would say, are some of the finest mechanical games ever created.
Yeah.
Like Rocket League is all mechanics,
yeah,
you know, like yeah. it has to be that way. And Bloodborne has to be that way too. Like any mistake you make in Bloodborne is yours. Like
right.
you know exactly how the controls work and your job is to then go through the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that happens in Metal Gear in a way that throws in emergence in mm-hmm. a way that doesn't necessarily appear in pretty much any other game except maybe Far Cry or something like that. Like the metaphor that Idle Thumbs always uses is the grenade rolls down the hill.
Right.
Where it's like I could not have known that this chain reaction of knocking over this tower would have alerted this guy, and that guy would have thrown a grenade,
and now
which
like
exploded
a somewhere.
Yeah, which yeah. exploded that which exploded that Jeep, which startled those wolves who are now right. attacking me. You know,
the butterfly effect of open world games.
Yeah, and right. and in a way that's not just in a way that's not scripted, but is not kind of overly in your face about it. Like you really have to look at it. You know, you really have to like subtly understand how all the items work. You can play the entire game as an action game if you wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
Like you can. It's just I think the amount of interactions is kind of astonishing, and it's almost it's delivering on the promise of what Metal Gear games always were to the people that were really hardcore about them
mm-hmm.
in a way that puts it front and center.
Right.
Like, all the Metal Gear games are kind of sandboxes, except they were always in a linear story. And now this is just, like, wander around and see what happens when you sneak into places.
Right. There's a sense I get from the game, too, that because the system is so tight, but it is an open-world game, every time you go to a new location,
mm-hmm.
it's almost like it's letting you know this the opportunity for this to happen has always been here.
Yes.
It's just yeah. about the pieces that are here
yeah.
and what you're doing with them.
Yeah.
And so instead of going... Oh, here's a very heavily cordoned off experience.
Mm-hmm.
So that I know you'll see this. It is a bunch of singular locations around a map through which you navigate and sort of try to predict how things will go based
yeah.
upon your existing knowledge, not just from this game, but from the franchise as a whole.
And like Bloodborne, it is improvisational, where it's like, I'm going to go through here and here's
right.
my route. And then all of a sudden, whoops, I forgot that when I walk on kind of a hollowed out wooden ceiling, the soldiers below can hear my footsteps. And now they're searching for me.
Right.
You know, so like, what am I going to do? Should I jump off the wall? Should I just whip out my rocket launcher? Should I call in a helicopter? Should I have my dog attack them? Should I have my sniper lady? Like, the amount of options you have is staggering.
Right.
Like, there are certain weapons that I've still never used.
Yeah.
I played this game for probably more than 60 hours.
Right.
Like, there are items that I don't know what they do.
You know,
like,
yeah.
the amount of stuff is wild. You know, it's just wild.
I also feel like those emergent moments make for great opportunities of humor in a way that Bloodborne... Yeah. I mean, Bloodborne certainly has them too.
Yeah.
When a skeleton just like gut punches you off a cliff or something.
Yeah.
But there's that unique flavor of... Like, I just remember one time I was going on a base and I was stealth killing everybody and then a sandstorm came.
Yeah.
And I started just killing dudes in the sandstorm because I got really frustrated. And then the sandstorm suddenly stopped.
Yeah.
And everyone was like, there he is. And I was like, oh my God, what's happening? And I just, you know, jump through windows and it becomes frantic. And it's this weird, almost like Pratt humor or something.
Yeah.
Because I'm falling through windows that I never planned on falling through.
You might be like bursting
through.
Out of a box.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Like,
or sliding down a hill on a box.
It's just, there have been times where I was in a sandstorm and accidentally literally bumped into a guy. It's like, oh, what are you doing here? And then you just start fighting each other. Like, yeah. I mean, it is.
I mean, that's happened in real life, too.
I mean, it's just, it's comical in a way that is, you know, the most Metal Gear-ish you can possibly be, which is so self-serious on one end, but mechanically open to so much silliness.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the game is overwhelming, though?
Because I mean, it is overwhelming. Like, I mean, I haven't used some weapons. That's crazy.
Yeah.
You know?
So it's a game that you sort of... I mean, it's on your list, I think, because you've been willing to push through that, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
To climb that hill.
I mean, but that's the thing. Like, it's also... You can also engage at it on a level that doesn't get into all that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is one of the other reasons why, in a way, it's a much more... it's a much more like audacious game than Bloodborne.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Like for as sprawling and crazy as Bloodborne is to me an admirably restrained game. Like it feels like Bloodborne is very measured in what it gives you, whereas Metal Gear is like, we just want to give as much as possible.
Yeah.
So like, we have these weird FOBs. Do you want to do base management? Sure, why not? Like, how about this weird multiplayer mode that's actually a pretty great multiplayer mode?
Yeah.
You know, like, what about, do you want to do like weapon upgrades and sights? Do you want to color your weapon a different color? Do you know you can customize your weapons in that game?
You mean like build?
Yeah, you can build custom weapons. You can name them. Build custom stocks.
Can you name them Big Boss and like D rifle?
Yeah, you can. Like, so you can build totally custom rifles with different parts and stuff that you collect. Like, it's all in there. It's all in there.
It's all in there. This is all the games.
I mean, do you want to play shitty Facebook games? That's in there too.
That's in there too. Sure. You know, like, I don't, but it's in there.
I mean, and then you have the whole meta level, like the nuclear disarmament thing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like...
The multiple endings.
Yeah, and also...
The Kojima drama that's boiled into the game.
I mean, that's the other thing. Like, and it's hard to reward a game for this, but I also think it's important to look at this game as a symbol of what... especially Japanese AAA game development, it looks like right now. And this almost feels like the last of its kind. Right. You know, like...
It's literally the last Kojima Metal Gear game in all likelihood.
Theoretically, I mean, it's... And, I mean, the amount of money they spent on this, and the game's still not finished. Like, it's clear that they pushed this game out early. You know, like, there's concept art, and there are unfinished cutscenes that people have dug up on the disc of a whole nother scenario that they didn't even get to because, you know, they were just kind of cut off. There's just a lot of... And, you know, at the same time, I it doesn't really get talked about too much because of some of the more puerile, like, parts of the game. Like, this game is messed up. Like, you know, Quiet is sexist and gross. That's, you know, that goes, you know... with no argument. But there are some parts of the story that are excellent. So spoilers for the end of Metal Gear Solid 5. There is a mission where... So towards the end of the game, you realize the big bad guy's goal is to spread a parasite around the world that reacts to the types of languages that people speak.
Wait, so there's like an English
virus.
Yeah.
Well, and that's the thing. They couldn't figure out if the English virus had been deployed yet. And that's one of the reasons why Quiet was quiet.
Oh, what?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
She Quiet could talk. She just refused to talk.
Because of fear that the parasite would trigger the moment she spoke
She was a carrier.
And she knew she was a carrier.
Of the English strain. And so like... You know,
she could have at least written on a fucking whiteboard, though.
Well, I mean, she was also sent by the bad guy to infiltrate the base specifically. Okay. So, like, she couldn't give that away since she was a double agent. But, like, various...
Hand gestures? I don't know.
Various other... Oh, she spoke in one of the Native American tongues to the...
Oh, really?
To Code Talker.
That's pretty sweet.
Because they... The bad guy didn't know that that language still existed.
Right.
Like, it was one of the Native American languages that only a few people knew or something. Anyway...
Anyway, Metal Gear Solid 5 is crazy.
Throughout, at a certain point, the parasite breaks out at Mother Base, and you don't know why it's broken out. And so you have to rearrange your people to figure out which people to quarantine, and you have to do it based on what languages they speak.
What?
Yeah.
In the in-game menu.
In the menu.
That you would normally use.
And it's like, oh, I thought this was just like a wacky fun thing because like, oh, this guy speaks Afrikaans and this guy speaks French or whatever. So you realize that the commonality is that they all speak a certain language.
What language is it?
I think that one was one of the African languages. I forget which one it was. That was a scripted event. Then later on, there's another scripted event where it's like, the parasite is mutated. Like, there's another outbreak on Mother Base. We've quarantined it to one section of Mother Base that we've cut off from the rest.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to go in there as Snake and either fix it or kill everyone in there.
Holy cow.
And so you play this whole mission where you're
on
going...
On your Mother Base.
On Mother Base, where you're going through this section... And there's a bunch of people, and you see their names because you've recruited them. It's like, oh, there's Raging Rhino and Angry Cockroach and Sneaky Gerbil or whatever. Those are all people you've captured earlier in the game.
Yeah.
And now you see them in this Mother Base, and they're all infected. And you're looking at them through these goggles that let you see if the parasite has kind of like traveled up their vocal cords. And it's like, they're like, Snake, you know, check out their vocal cords first before you kill them. Because you might be able to save some of them. You can't save any of them. That's just trolling you.
It's
you're going to have to go in there and shoot every single person.
There's no way to save them.
No, there's nothing. Even though they build up your hope by saying, oh, you might be able to save a few of them. You can't save any of them.
Because they all have the parasite?
They all have the parasite, and they're all infected.
Oh my gosh.
And so some of them... So, like, you're going through this corridor, Snake's wearing a gas mask, so all you see him is, like, a mask and his eyes kind of, like, looking at people. And you're just like... Looking at them, you see they're infected, and you have to shoot them. And every time you point your gun at someone, their little name pops up, because that's how the game mechanically works. Like, it shows the name pop up. And, you know, people are, you know, some of the scientists and people are, like, sobbing and crying, and some of the soldiers are, like, kind of gone crazy, like they don't want to die or whatever, so they're fighting back. And then you finally...
What does this parasite do? Will it kill you?
Yeah, it's kind of like Ebola or something like that. Like, you start coughing up blood and stuff. So you finally make it into kind of like a part where some of the soldiers are still there and still loyal to you. And you look at all of them and they're all infected. And they're like, do what you need to do, boss. And they all are saluting.
Oh,
like
my
this.
God. No.
And you're just looking and the...
Ready to die.
Yeah, ready. And like there just so happens, of course, to be a stereo that is like playing, you know... one of the songs or whatever,
like a dirge.
As you're doing, so you hear some, you know, in universe soundtrack, and all of these guys are like, "It's been an honor, boss," and they're just like saluting, and you just have to mow them down.
Oh my god!
And so you're just, and then you finally get out. You think you're going to save one person because you find someone that's not infected. By the time you get him to the door, he's infected. So you just have, he's like sitting there on the ground and he's like, sorry, boss. And you just have to put a bullet in his head. So you have to kill like 50 dudes. And it's not even really an action sequence because they're not fighting back.
Yeah.
You're just walking through this corridor, killing people to prevent this parasite.
And this is like the benefit of having a game of that scale.
Yeah.
Means there's all these little elements that, like the fact that you know their language already and you've named them, because that is an additional mechanic you've been playing around with for hours.
These are all people you've recruited and all people that you've probably sent on missions. Some of these people you could play as, because you can play as other people when you go on side ops. You can deploy as some of your soldiers. So
you could be killing one of the people you were playing.
You could easily
as.
Have been killing those people. And so the like Metal Gear always does, every once in a while, the mechanics and the story intertwine in this incredible way.
Right.
That's dozens of hours in.
Yeah, and it shows a knowledge of the systems that are already in there.
Yes.
Of how they can be played around with.
And like a classic Kojima willingness to just fuck with the player.
Yeah.
It's like, oh yeah, you might be able to save some of these guys. Nope, you're just going to have to shoot every single one of them.
In past GOTY conversations, one of the hallmarks of the type of game that we're looking for when we decide what game we want on our list, mm-hmm. and at least certainly for me, is one that can sort of fill me with a sense of wonder of yeah. like, well, you know, not only wonder at what I'm seeing and the fact that yeah. it's been made, but wonder at what games can do.
Yep.
And like there's hope and opportunities for games as a medium. Mm. And that sounds like a fucked up story. But yeah. Kojima, I mean, you know, this guy is taken so seriously and is followed so fiercely in the industry because he exhibits that ability to understand what he's working with
yep.
and innovate around it and within that space to a mind-boggling degree.
Yeah.
Like he's a he's like a virtuoso. He's yeah. like a he's like an orchestra conductor.
I mean, he is probably the best.
He's a Steve Jobs.
He's like the auteur. Yeah.
Yeah.
In all the positive and negative ways, but I feel like that can only come out of that
yeah.
environment.
So are you excited then for Kojima to make something outside of the Konami umbrella?
I mean, sure. I mean, I don't know what he'll do. I don't know what he'll do with it. Like, I don't know if
I'm sure they're just going to give him as much money as they could fling at him.
I don't know. I mean, it's interesting because you have to think that in a certain way, the stress and the probably what is, you know, almost the creative antagonism is almost mm-hmm. a good thing a little bit. Like you can tell he almost, it feels like he sometimes like resented being stuck in the Metal Gear universe so much that he was willing to say like, oh yeah, just kidding. You're going to play as Raiden the whole game. You know, right. like it's almost like a resentfulness that made the games even better. You
know, like, and now he might not have that.
Right. It's like, yeah. I don't know what happens.
He
like,
might be
like,
too happy.
At right. Exactly. Like what's his edge now?
Well, you know what we could do is just start sending him hate mail, yeah. you know?
I mean, I think, I don't know, the game.
We need to become his villain is what you're saying.
He needs we need something. To
be, he is the Batman. We must be the Joker.
We are his Phantom.
That's
exactly. Well, I mean, and I told you how the game ends, right? Like, even yeah. that, like, oh, just kidding, you weren't Big Boss the whole time.
Right.
You know? I mean, at the end, also, after you kill all these guys, you're going to bury them at sea. You burn them into ashes or whatever. Mm-hmm. Instead of doing that, Snake instead spreads the ashes of the dead guys on his face and then with the rest of the ashes compresses them into diamonds and then you what? Wear it on your shoulder for the rest of the game.
Oh my god, that's so metal.
Yeah.
That's what I think that's probably what Kojima would want when he goes. Yeah.
The real diamond dog.
Compress me into you can pay that. You can have someone compress your ashes into diamonds.
I mean it's just an incredible game in the literal sense of the word where it's kind of unbelievable that it happened. And you kind of feel like it's probably never going to happen again.
Right.
A
once-in-a-lifetime experience.
Yeah. And, you know, it's not perfect. And in any other year, I probably just would have said Bloodborne. But kind of the sheer, like, audacity and also the mechanical triumph of it was... I can't think of another time where I've been so surprised that a game actually worked.
Right.
Like, I'm shocked yeah. that this game actually worked. And I'm like, fascinated to see if this game will at all have any resonance, like, throughout the industry, because this is by far the best stealth game I've ever played.
Yeah.
You know?
But it's in such a non-replicable environment.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's like, could you do that at all? Like, I mean, after...
I mean, maybe if you had a budget of many, many, many millions.
Yeah, and also, like, a willingness to spend years and years making a game. Like,
yeah.
it's hard to take an Assassin's Creed game seriously after this.
Right.
You know, it's like, it's...
Well, it's been hard to take an Assassin's Creed seriously for a while, Scott.
I guess that's true. It's just, it's something that is like a truly special game, even though there's a bunch of flaws and like annoying parts in it. And the scale of the game is enormous in an unrestrained way. Whereas yeah. the scale of Bloodborne is enormous, but in a way that is very meticulous.
Yeah.
This game is... It feels like Kojima was, for the most part, until they kind of woke up and took everything away from him, was completely indulged.
Yeah.
You know? Like,
yeah.
And that's something that I feel like, I don't know, that doesn't, even with Miyamoto, that doesn't happen. You know? Yeah. Like, it's, so anyway, that's, you should play Metal Gear Solid 5, everyone. You really don't need to, since I've talked about it for so many hours on this yeah. podcast, but like, it's an incredible game.
Cool.
Yeah.
It was a good year for games, I think.
Oh, yeah. And kind of secretly. Like, I didn't really know what to expect in 2015.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, there was, like, all these hits that came out.
Yeah. And a diverse selection, right? Like, yeah. I've got a platformer, mm-hmm. user-generated content, a story game about a young girl coming of age.
Yeah.
And a gut demon, gut ripping, bloody horror, incredibly difficult Bloodborne.
Yeah, it's a good variety, and all games that you can basically recommend to, like, fans of video games as a medium.
Yes.
People would all enjoy these things. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like, oh, this is a really inside baseball game and you really have to, like, have played all of the Call of Duties to appreciate this. Like,
yeah.
You know, this is like, you could give any of these games to people and say, this is a good example of why video games are cool.
Yeah.
And it would be totally fine.
Yeah.
You know?
They might not beat them all.
Yeah. But
they could definitely learn something from them.
Yeah. And also, we're going to do another podcast next week where we talk about some of the things that, some of the games that got left off the list.
But are important.
Yeah, but are important ones, and I think there's some pretty heavy hitters on that list,
totally,
too.
100% agree. Yeah, I'm sure there are a lot of games that are on your guys' list that didn't make ours.
Yeah.
The Witcher being one of them. But hey, you know, that there's could be something very valuable there. So many games.
Cool. Well, experiencepoints.net and experiencepoints@gmail.com is the email address.
Yeah, and if you want to give us our holiday gifts.
Yeah.
In the mail. Don't bother. We have plenty.
Nah, we got everything.
Except for
stars.
Except for sweet, sweet
stars. Delicious stars.
Some stars from Mario games.
Yeah.
But you can leave us a star rating on iTunes and Stitcher.
Yep.
It helps us find new listeners
for
2016. So, season one of Experience Points. I'm just kidding. What there's like 360 episodes?
60, I don't know. One podcast for every day of the year.
Almost.
Yeah.
Almost. Actually, we're probably there if you consider non-numbered
podcasts. Yeah, exactly.
Podcasts.
The stealth podcast that we release.
Yeah, you can listen to a podcast every day for a year.
Yeah.
And we'll have more.
And then go crazy. All right, everyone. We will be talking to you next week. Thank you so much for listening.
Happy holidays.